Hi, I'm Robert Wall from HBO's Arliss, now streaming on HBO Go, HBO Now.
I'm Mitch Albom of the Detroit Free Press and the author of the new book, The Next Person You Meet in Heaven.
I'm Mike Lupica, MSNBC and MLB.com. Welcome to the Monday edition of the Sports Reporters Podcast. An extremely busy day in the NFL, and we have to start with what will go down as one of the most famous plays in the history of the NFL, the double lateral play by the Dolphins against the Patriots. It has about six different playoff implications. We will get to why Rob Gronkowski was at the back end of the Patriots defense. Apparently, Bill Belichick thought that Ryan Tannehill was capable of throwing about an 85-yard Hail Mary. But we now have an NFL moment, guys, that is exactly like Cal and the Stanford Band.
Yeah, except against the Patriots. You know, that would be one of those things that would have been a highlight moment between two teams that were kind of out of it. But against the Patriots, who are supposed to be able to prepare for all things everywhere, and now you read that Tannehill, when they saw that Rob Gronkowski was back there, said, oh, we got this. And in hindsight, when you see the last move that the guy puts on, and you see Gronkowski almost breaks an ankle trying to turn and catch up with him, you realize, yeah, you can't put a guy that big in the back if it's not going to be a Hail Mary pass. So they totally guessed wrong, and football still is about guessing. And then they had the wrong personnel on the field for the old, you know, hook and ladder, constant lateral play. And this is going to go down not only, Mike, as you know, a Cal Stanford thing, which didn't have, I don't remember, it didn't have huge ramifications for the national title, I don't think. This could have ramifications for the playoffs. You know, this could affect whether or not New England's on the road or at home during the playoffs. It could affect the whole standings. This wasn't just another game. This might even help get Miami to qualify for the playoffs. So it had significance as well as being, you know, something out of the Keystone Cops.
Hey, Robert, by the way, Dan Shaughnessy, our pal, the great columnist for the Boston Globe, wrote last night that it may be the worst non-playoff loss in Boston sports history. What do you think about that?
Well, you know what's interesting is my goddaughter, who's a big sports fan, she's about 23 years old, she came in just screaming about this play, and I said, reminded me, of course, of the Cal Stanford play, which, of course, was before she was born, which scared the hell out of me. But I showed it to her, and we were going through the band, and that's the great thing about sports, how generational it can be when you talk about great moments, and sometimes they interlink with something else that happened before, and you have a learning moment. Now, getting back to the actual game, what I sure everybody wanted to do is, what is Belichick gonna not say at the press conference? Because Belichick is one of these guys where never have so many watched one guy say so few. And because, you know, out of all the teams you want it to happen to, I guess it is the Patriots more than anything else.
Well, it's not only there's something about the Patriots in Miami that doesn't make sense. You know, they shouldn't have the struggles against Miami that they do. Same thing was, we'll later talk about Pittsburgh and Oakland. Doesn't make sense, but for some reason that happens. And weirdly, you know, Miami has a much better record against New England than their overall record should suggest. But I want you to write down these names, folks, and remember them forever if this really affects the New England Patriots. Kenyon Drake, Kenny Stills, Devontae Parker. You couldn't pick those guys out of a lineup. Those three guys and Ryan Tannehill throwing the pass ran through the entire New England Patriots defense. There were moments there where it looked like some of the Patriots are going, well, you know, this isn't going to go all the way. We don't really have it. There wasn't that exact sense of urgency amongst the defenders that you would expect. And then when it suddenly looked at one cut, that one block that turned the whole thing upfield, and all of a sudden you see Gronkowski trying to keep up with the speedy receiver, and he's not going to do it. I thought he went out of bounds. I don't know, Mike,
Mitch. I thought the play finally changed, and recent pro football history changed. It looked like the Patriots thought when Drake cut to the middle of the field that he was going to lateral one more time.
Right, right.
And I thought they let up for just a second. And then we got to go back to Gronkowski. The irony of this is he probably played his best game of the year on offense yesterday. What he was doing out there, I don't understand. Because once you realize they're as far away from the goal line as they were when the play started, He can only be doing one thing on the field, having to make a tackle, not knock a pass down. And once he had to make a tackle, you saw the kid blow by him.
Yeah.
Isn't it great? You mentioned about Miami and New England, how even in bad times, how Miami gives New England fits. And I'm old enough to remember growing up, the Green Bay Packers would dominate, except the Minnesota Vikings. I don't know if you remember, but Tarkington would give Packers fits. It's one of those great things about interdivision rivalries. Kansas City can be lousy, and they're going to give Oakland fits. You know, it's just one of those great things, but it is the matchups, for whatever reason, Miami gives the Patriots fits. Yeah.
Well, this time it could cost them. I mean, we'll see how this plays out. New England doesn't have the toughest of schedules the rest of the way. But here we are in mid-December, and the playoffs are – I mean, we know a couple of teams that are definitely in. But other than that, the whole thing is a mess. And that's the way the NFL likes it. You know, there's a lot of teams that are with seven wins that are still in contention for this whole thing. And every time you think you got it figured out, something flips over. Now, I don't want to say that there's some problem with New England, because that's a freak way to lose a game. Although, you know, it's not like they were blowing Miami
out. Right.
They left so many points on the board. Brady said after the game that he thought they had one more timeout at the end of the first half. They had first and goal on the two and come away with no points. Yeah. Gostkowski misses an extra point and an easy field goal. Oh, I think it's fair to say that something might be wrong with the Patriots, because here, throughout this amazing Patriots run that goes back to the start of the partnership of Brady and Belichick, so many times they just had to win two games to get to the Super Bowl. It does not look like that's going to be the case this time. And you know what? Finally, the AFC East really got up and bit them yesterday, because the Dolphins, by the way, kept their own playoff chances alive.
That's right. That's why it was significant, you know, on both ends. I mean, that play may have saved any hope of a season for Miami. So it wasn't just, hey, we beat the Patriots, now we go back to stinking. They're actually in a playoff hunt. And that makes the next week's game against the Steelers for New England a really interesting game, because you want to talk about weird endings and teams that shouldn't be losing. Once again, this is a parallel going on with Pittsburgh. One more time, Ben Roethlisberger cannot win against Oakland. He's been around forever and a day. You know, they're in the AFC. Four times he's gone out there to play against Oakland. Four times he has now lost. Yesterday, he was out for a stretch with a rib problem, came back, led the team down the field, only to watch that game fall apart in the final seconds. I didn't think Oakland was beating anybody else the rest of the year. I mean, they just have looked terrible. And, you know, arguably the worst or one of the worst teams in the NFL knocks off Pittsburgh just when it looks like they're getting their act together, just when it looks like all right, we've survived the Le'Veon Bell thing and we're charging, we got our defense going.
Yeah, but they had lost two in a row coming into this game. And Mitch, here, what theory did you apply? I forget what game we were talking about the other day. Bet the team that needs it more. Okay, the more desperate team will be the Steelers next week against the Patriots, because all of a sudden they're fighting for their playoff lives. Okay. They almost can't withstand a loss. And where is the game? The game is at Heinz Field next weekend. So the Patriots made a world. I know that, you know, and the Steelers had partly to blame that awful field they were playing on in Oakland, which never seems to get better and nobody in the NFL is going to miss. But man, oh man, I'm telling you, the Patriots, they may have to go on the road. Oh no, this is might be the first sign of the apocalypse for this year's Patriots.
Well, you mentioned the big thing about going on the road, because I think this year more than ever, I'm watching the Rams, and the Rams are a totally different team when they're on the road. I mean, we've saw it when they went to New Orleans. They saw it when they went to Chicago. Actually, in the last couple of weeks, we've seen two defenses, Chicago and Dallas, really assert themselves in a league which is totally offensive or offensively oriented. And you know, and I'm watching wonderful teams. I mean, I'm enjoying Houston, and I'm enjoying Kansas City. And the most underrated and underappreciated of them all, maybe Andrew Luck. It's just a terrific year for quarterbacks this year, I think. It's exciting to watch these young quarterbacks and the blend of the old and the new. I'm just really enjoying it.
Well, it's I mean, we could probably write a
and Philip Rivers
about quarterback, not old and new. I mean, there are a lot of young quarterbacks that are really making names for themselves and coming on, like the Trubiskys and others. And there are, the quarterbacks that we've kind of forgotten about, like Rivers, who are saying, "Hey, what about me?" Deshaun Watson. We'll get to all those games in a second here. Finish up on the Pittsburgh situation. They've now lost three in a row, as you point out, Mike. Two of them on the road, all close games. They lost to Denver. They lost to San Diego, which, you know, I'm San Diego. I'm going to forever say San Diego when
too.
I see Chargers.
I
don't know. It's just a generational thing. To the Chargers, which, okay, is understandable. They lost by 3 points, and the Chargers are a really good team this year. And now they've lost on the road to the Raiders, and now they play the Patriots. They cannot get away from Baltimore, who despite losing, is still right on their tail.
It was a heartbreaking loss for the Ravens yesterday.
Very tough loss, because they really, you know, I mean, they're playing arguably the best team in the AFC, and they hung with them the whole way. And then the injury, of course, they're down to their third quarterback. You know, RG3 ends up throwing for them. But, you know, I don't know what's going to happen with Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh is a Russian novel this year. From the way that they have started, the Le'Veon Bell stuff, the surge that they had, I mean, for a stretch, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, they won 6 in a row in the middle of the season after losing 2 of their first 3. Now they've lost 3 in a row. I'm not sure who they are. I'm not sure that they're making the playoffs. So they got the Patriots, the Saints, and the Bengals the rest of the way. So, you know, they could easily lose 2 of those 3. And you lose 2 of those 3, I don't know that you're going to the playoffs.
When you look at the standings, somehow they're still in first place in the AFC North, okay? The tie has them ahead of the Ravens. And, if the Ravens, you know, it's funny. It's so much fun to follow an NFL Sunday on Twitter, because there was a lot of ball spiking going on when the Ravens took the lead against the Chiefs. Like, the game was over, and I'm thinking, well, wait a minute. Is Patrick Mahomes no longer playing for the Kansas City Chiefs? And then, of course, he makes unbelievable plays. So that division is very much up for grabs. The Texans finally lost a game yesterday. And I'll tell you, if you want to put a bow around what we saw in the AFC and all these bad losses yesterday, maybe the thing to be talking about is the Chiefs hanging in there, coming back to tie that game, nearly winning it in regulation after Lamar Jackson fumbles, okay? And if we had forgotten how great Patrick Mahomes has been.
Yep.
And I love Philip Rivers. I don't see how anybody other than Mahomes can be the MVP. When he had to make plays, third down plays down the field, and, you know, nobody's talking about Kareem Hunt yesterday because everybody was talking about Tyreek Hill, who is unbelievable in that game every time Mahomes had to get the ball to him.
You know what's also interesting, Mitch, going back to something you said about the Steelers. When you think of all the little – the losses that Cleveland had at the beginning of the year, it is conceivable. Their last three games are Denver, Cincinnati, and Baltimore. If they win all three of those games, which it's possible, it's conceivable they win the division.
Cleveland. Yeah, I know. I looked at that.
It's conceivable.
They are not out of it, which makes us here in Detroit feel really stupid. But Cleveland is actually not out of it, given the division that they're in and given their win yesterday over a team that's going the absolute opposite direction, the Carolina Panthers. Maybe on some other week when we don't have so many teams that are making the playoffs, we can talk about what the hell happened to the Carolina Panthers, who were, I think, 6-2 at one point, and now are literally spiraling backwards. I don't know if that team, that coach, isn't taken apart. But, yeah, I mean, hats off to the Cleveland Browns, who finally proved the theory that if you get enough number one draft picks, eventually you can learn how to win a game. Because every time, every time I turn over to see a Cleveland Browns highlight thing, it feels like I'm watching a college football All-Star game from 2 and 3 and 4 years ago. You know, every name I've heard of, you know, it is Mayfield or Chubb or all the Ward or all the other guys that they have on there. I say, well, of course, you know, when you lose that many games, that many years in a row, and you keep getting these number one picks, eventually these guys some of them have to be good. And so they've come back, and hats off to them. But you know, if they make it, that's a long shot. There are other stories atop.
Oh my God! Yes, we have to get out of the NFC. We have to get out of the AFC North because none of these teams we're talking about are going to win the Super Bowl this year. But there were two fascinating games yesterday. Apart from the Dolphins and the Patriots, and you guys pick which one you want to talk about. I thought the Cowboys had a great win because the Eagles actually looked a little bit like the team that won the Super Bowl. They made their last stand yesterday, and then last night's game. We've been talking about this game. There have been two offense versus defense games that might be telling in January. One was the Cowboys beating the Saints when they were scoring 100 points a game, and then what the Bears did to the Rams.
Yeah.
Al Michaels kept talking about how the Rams want the playoffs to go to the through the Coliseum.
Yeah.
We saw why last night.
Yeah.
All right, I want to start with that one, Mike, because I've been thinking about that one. You know, this is in my backyard. I've watched the Bears play against the Lions, beat them twice. I've seen the Rams here, and you remember me saying last week, I am not that impressed with the Rams on the road. They struggled against Detroit. You struggle against Detroit, that's a bad sign. And then they came into Chicago and laid an egg in terms of their performances there, and it was almost all the Chicago defense, but it wasn't 100% the Chicago defense. The Rams, their numbers were atrocious. I mean, Gurley's numbers were atrocious. The interceptions by Goff were atrocious. He actually was asked afterwards, is everything okay with you? And he said, yeah, I'm going okay. I just have to play better. And I think, was it Gurley said, we just played like whatever, you know? Here's what I want to bring up. I was curious about this, so I went and looked at it. Last year, the Chicago Bears were 5-11. The year before, they were 3-13. To turn a team around with a first-year coach to probably, if you look at their schedule, they're probably going to end up 11-5. They're probably going to flip their record from last year. To have that happen that fast in a division where Green Bay and Minnesota have dominated for years, I mean, and I don't know how much you can say about their new coach. I don't know how much you can say about Khalil Mack. I mean, you look at, yes, those are the biggest differences, that and Trubisky has come into his own. But they are playing with a defensive dominance now that is unseen anywhere else in the league. Even all the other best teams don't have a defense like this one where they're just gleeful. Honestly, they like can't wait to get out there and smash you to pieces and disrupt you. And it wasn't just quarterback pressure. It was interceptions yesterday. I am in awe of the turnaround that they have pulled off in Chicago.
Let me tell you something. They scored a touchdown last night, and they made it stand up, okay? And maybe they can do that through January. Trubisky last night played the worst game of any quarterback whose team won in the National Football League yesterday. He barely threw for 100 yards. His quarterback rating was 31, okay? He made two insane... He played better than Goff did. He played better than Goff did because the fact is he wasn't playing against Khalil Mack, even though he was playing against Aaron Donald. And I just... Maybe they can win 15-9 all the way to Atlanta. I just don't see it. And I do not like the way Trubisky throws the ball. I am so not convinced about Mitch Trubisky.
Well, I got to jump in here, too, because I tend to agree with Mike about the Trubisky thing, because somewhere in the playoffs, you have to have a quarterback who can bring you from 12, from two scores down.
Yeah,
I don't, against a quality team. Let's not forget, last week, Chicago lost to the Giants. Do you know? So, you talk about how a team has turned around in 1 year. Doesn't Chicago remind you a little bit of what the Rams did last year with the first-year coach? I mean, how they turned that around? And I think they are a year away. I don't know about Trubisky. And eventually, like I said, when it comes to pro football, it's about the quarterback. It's about the quarter. Eventually, it's going to be about a guy who can bring you back from two scores down in a playoff game. And I'm not sold on Trubisky either.
Well, I'm not burying him so fast. This is a kid who's had a really good season, and he didn't have a
not
great game.
Him.
He didn't have a great game against a very good team last night. I think he's capable, Mike, of rising up. I've seen much better performances out of him than obviously both quarterbacks stunk last night. You wouldn't judge Jared Goff off of his performance last night either and say, well, that's his watermark. And I wouldn't do that against Trubisky. I think he's not Tom Brady, but with that defense, you know, Jim McMahon wasn't the greatest quarterback either. And they won themselves a title riding a defense and him just not screwing things up. And they can absolutely win the NFC. I bar none, I'm telling you, I've watched them all year. They can win the NFC. They can beat the Saints. They've already proven they can beat the Rams. I mean, who's going to get in their way? They can win the NFC. I'm not going to say they're going to, but they can win the NFC with Trubisky. I don't know if they're going to win a Super Bowl because I don't know who they're going to play, but they can win the NFC with Trubisky.
Mitch, he may become a very fine NFL quarterback. Okay, all I'm saying is he's the worst starting quarterback of any contending team this year. Okay, that's one thing. Two, he didn't play. Chase Daniel played better in relief than Trubisky played last night, and it will catch. And if you're going to be a game manager, and that's all they're asking him to be, you can't turn the ball over. And he threw the ball a mile over two wide open guys last night. Okay, when I thought that they actually had some offensive momentum going, and. Yeah. Is their defense better than the Cowboys? Yeah, their defense is better than the Cowboys. But the Cowboys had a quarterback who threw for 450 yards yesterday. And the Cowboys, even though they're not as good as the Bears on defense, they have two extraordinary offensive weapons in Amari Cooper and Ezekiel Elliott. And that is why if I'm making a bet right now, I like the Cowboys better than I like the Bears.
Really?
Well,
yeah, I do.
It's tough because, you know, Prescott's the other one. I got to correct Mitch on something. The year the Bears win the Super Bowl, they had the number one offense in the National Football League.
Yeah, that's it wasn't based on amazing performances by Jim McMahon.
He was good.
He was good, and he had a pretty damn good running back behind him, too.
Yeah,
he was good. I mean, I'm just saying, it wasn't dazzling. Jim McMahon was never dazzling. He made the plays when he had to make them. He was tough. But I think Trubisky is... He's capable. I'm not saying he's Jim McMahon. I'm not saying he's anybody else. But Trubisky, on the overall year, he's got, 20 touchdowns. And even with last night's 9 interceptions, he hits about 66% of his passes. He's good enough with that defense to win the NFC. And, Mike, if that game between Dallas and Chicago's in Chicago, I'll pick Chicago.
Well, no, Mitch, then maybe if it's the championship game, I'm just saying the Bears are, it's unlikely that the Bears are going to get to play every playoff game and unless the bottom falls out of the rest of the contenders at Soldier Field this year. And so they're not going to be playing in 25 degrees. They're not going to be playing on a Sunday night. And the conditions, absolutely. You could see the Rams after about a quarter said, oh, man, it's too cold. I don't want to play here anymore. But again, that game... It's a different game if it is it's 75 degrees and sunny in the Los Angeles Coliseum.
I've always believed this about bowl games, just go on a tangent for a second, that because they play all these college bowl games in the South and under perfect conditions, that Midwest Big Ten teams have a distinct disadvantage. I would love to see a college bowl game for a national championship being played in Ann Arbor.
In the snow.
I would love it. And I think people would love it. What's the most famous game ever played? The Ice Bowl. I think that all these...
We thought we might get one when the Super Bowl came. Jersey, right. And it was balmy that day.
I know, but I'd love to see that because they're built differently, the teams, in the Midwest. It's like Parcells says, when do they come at the New York weather? I would love to see Florida State and Miami and Alabama have to come up to Columbus, to come up to Ann Arbor and play it in February.
Well, you're right. You're right. And most of the biggest championship games, semifinals and finals, end up being played in these massive indoor stadiums wherever they are. So you're playing in 72 degrees all the time, and weather is never a factor.
Correct.
Even the heat isn't a factor anywhere. And that's a fair point. And yeah, the Bears are 9-4 and they're chasing teams that have 11 wins. So yeah, if everybody wins out and everybody holds serve, the championship's not likely to be played in Chicago, but that's assuming that the Saints and the Rams don't get knocked off earlier. I think there are holes in both of those. There's no perfect team here. There's nobody that looks like they're going to charge on. I just bet on defense in January. I just bet on defense.
But here's what I'm saying about the Cowboys, okay? And I obviously, you go off of what you're seeing now as opposed to what you saw in the first half of the season. But if you watched the Cowboys over the last 3 weeks, okay, and you didn't know that they began this run with five losses, okay, Wouldn't you think offense, defense, running, passing, all that stuff, wouldn't you think that you are now maybe watching the most complete team in the sport right now? Yesterday, Prescott, 455 yards. Ezekiel Elliott at 113. And I know he, you know, whatever, he was a knothead off the field, and he deserved to get suspended. But on the field, he's as tough a running back as there is in the league. And Amari Cooper, all he did was catch 217 yards worth of passes yesterday. And even though they got lucky on the winning play, all I'm saying is the Cowboys, to me, have as much momentum as anybody in this sport, and they're the closest thing I'm looking at, the eye test now, to be in the complete package.
Yeah. Amari Cooper, we've talked about this before, has changed that game, changed that team, more than one player ought to be able to change a team. And sometimes it's just the position that you come in and what you how you sort of shake up the other dominoes on the board. I see a quote from Prescott as I'm looking through the stuff saying, I guess I would say I was astonished that we were able to get that trade. So is everybody else in the league. But that's what Oakland is doing for everybody, giving away their best players and trying to stockpile draft picks. So, okay, for a first-round draft pick next year, which, you know, if the Cowboys win as much as they do, it ain't going to be a high draft pick. Now Amari Cooper gives Dak Prescott an option that he didn't have before and makes defenses – have to wonder, all right, is he going to that guy or is he going to Ezekiel Elliott? That's all Zeke Elliott needs, is that bit of hesitation on a defensive, on a linebacker's position, or they run block or they pass blocking, and he can take advantage of that hole. Cooper, even when he's not catching the ball, and he catches a lot of balls, and the one that, come on, the one that he got for the touchdown yesterday was, you couldn't make that thing happen. If you tried 100 times, you couldn't flip that ball up like that and get him to catch it. But he even when he's not catching the ball, is affecting that team, allowing that running game to open up, taking the pressure off that offensive line, which hadn't been as great as it usually is before he got there. And you're right. He has changed that team around. But, Mike, and I have never seen this before. Robert, I don't know if you're a student of football. They got the ball to start overtime, and they almost ran the clock
out.
Yep. I mean, what actually happens? Is there any contingency for that? If they had gone another minute and a half and then had scored, do the Eagles have the right to say, well, wait a minute, like, will we ever get, don't get anything here? We didn't even, the time ran out?
I think time runs out.
And I know that both teams, this is actually, I don't know the answer to this question, because both teams, if you don't score, if the first team to get the ball doesn't score a touchdown, by rule, both teams get the ball. But I have a feeling that if the clock runs out, and I never really, it was like 2 minutes around, you know, I wasn't really thinking that was going to happen. They would have had to make another first down and then run three plays from first and goal. But yeah, it was kind of fun watching them grind it out. And once again, you see the importance of a coin flip in overtime, especially when we get to the playoffs.
In an age of unprecedented offense with quarterbacks, I am enjoying a lot watching two running backs, especially, well, three, Gurley and Ezekiel Elliott, and still to watch Saquon Barkley. This guy, you know, I watch him, and every time I see him, he reminds me of somebody else. He reminds me a little bit of Earl Campbell. Then he reminds me a little bit of, God help me, Jim Brown. Then I watch him a little bit less, and he reminds me of Herschel Walker. And this, I'm just impressed watching this guy. And then Elliott. These guys are terrific. I mean, in a game that's so geared towards to the offense and wide receivers and passing, these guys are sure making it fun to watch.
Hmm. Well, they did a beat down on Washington, but then, you know, Washington's not the Washington that it was. Obviously, the quarterback situation is horrendous. But
Washington lost big, Mitch, but you know who's winning? Colin Kaepernick is winning collusion case.
Thank you.
He's winning his collusion case because when you watch Josh Johnson and Mark Sanchez. But I'm telling you something.
And
then you hear, well, Sanchez has a relationship with the coaches. Oh, yeah. Try selling that to Redskins fans. So I think the Redskins lost big yesterday, but Colin Kaepernick may have won big because every week a team like the Redskins is proving his collusion case against National Football League owners.
Well, I like what you said about Barkley. I hope he's not one of those running backs that has amazing performances early in his career for perennially losing teams. And then, you know, age and hits get start to catch up with him. You know, I watched Barry Sanders get wasted year after year here in Detroit. And you always wondered with a guy like Barry Sanders, who was a singular talent, had he gone to a different team, you know, what might his career be like? I mean, he still has a reputation that's, you know, people want to watch those highlights of Barry Sanders. And you realize, wow, look at that run. Wow, look at that run. And then I remember, yeah, and they lost that game, you know, 30-14. And you don't want Saquon Barkley to have all these highlights year after year in a team that goes, you know, 5-11. So I do hope for his sake that New York turns it around in the near future.
I think the Giants are beginning to convince themselves that they can get another year out of Eli Manning, which is another year that when they don't get the quarterback of the future, and I will say this again, if the Jets are right about Sam Darnold, I don't care how good Barkley is. The Giants were wrong not to take Sam Darnold. And yesterday, even though it was the Bills, even though it was on the road, the kid had been hurt. You saw flashes of what he might be able to do over the next 5 or 10 years for the New York Jets. And I'm not anointing him by any stretch, but the Giants seem to have this idea that they can get a great quarterback anytime that they want to. And I'm not sure it works that way in the National Football League.
No. And you know, they're playing themselves right out of any high draft pick anyhow.
Right. Right.
So, you know, they're going to end up 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. They're not getting a quarterback of the future at that pick.
Tell that to Pat Mahomes.
Well, unless
tell that to Aaron Rodgers.
Yeah. All right, Mike, I know you got to get out of here. Flight to catch. Thank you for your input. And have safe travels.
Yeah, Mitch, it's a labor of love. The great Pete Hamill, one of my best friends and one of my heroes, is being honored tonight in New York City. And I am one of the speakers, and I can't miss it.
All right, off you go.
Mitch, I find it interesting this year in a league, in a world where everybody holds on to their precious draft choices and their precious prospects, that the two teams that traded away their number one draft choice could conceivably, as you put it, wind up meeting in the NFC Championship, and that's Armani Cooper with the Dallas Cowboys and Khalil Mack with the Chicago Bears. This reluctance to trade prospects, that's the fans. That's because, oh, we can't trade the future. For these guys, the future, I'm a George Allen guy. The future is now.
I totally agree. I've watched this in, and you know, you can make this argument in all sports, although you really make it in football. And I don't know why. The one that, for example, that is still haunting here is the Lions trading Golden Tate for a third-round draft pick in the middle of the season. And there is this sense amongst these GMs that a pick in hand is better than a player in front of you. And I don't get it. And the teams that have decided, no, you know what? Let's get the player in front of us. He's already playing well. We know what he's capable of doing. Let's try him on our team. Let's see how Khalil Mack looks in a Chicago Bears uniform because we know what he can do. No one is thinking about who that number one pick might be. You know, same thing with Amari Cooper. Hey, we know what he can do, and we know that we have a quarterback who needs a receiver desperately now. Let's not wait until we pick some kid from college and see if he pans out. Let's give away the number one pick. Both of those teams, if they continue on the route that they're on, their picks are going to be 20 or above, right?
Yeah.
How many guys 20 or above hugely impact the teams the way that Khalil Mack or the way that Amari Cooper are impacting the teams right now?
I would think that would be zero.
Well, it might be one or two along the way. Not saying, you know, that Dan Marino was in
right,
the 20s and things like
there
that.
There you
go. But you know, I can point to just as many guys who are even higher picks than the 20s and didn't affect their team or took years to do so. By that point, the team has turned itself over and you don't even need that guy at that position as much as you did.
Especially if you're not getting, like you said, if it's the number one pick in the draft that you have no control over, unless then at least you can pick your guy. You know who you're getting. But beyond that, you really don't know. It's a crapshoot. And like you said, most of these guys do not pan out to the level of a guy you're giving up. Those three names we've mentioned, these are proven commodities in the National Football League. And it's happening in baseball, too. Look at that Paul Goldschmidt trade this week, where, you know, where they just pretty much gave away Paul Goldschmidt. It's again, for prospects. You know, again,
yeah.
Now, it's different in baseball because the money's a little bit different. But it's of course, but the haves are really starting to separate from the have-nots in baseball.
Yeah,
I'm
yeah. Well, because, you know, baseball still doesn't have a salary cap. And so, you know, if you've got extra money coming in from the market that you happen to be in or the television deal that you happen to be in and you can afford to make mistakes, you can afford to pay guys who are no longer playing for you, you know, and still pay out on their contracts, that's fine. I've watched, again, I'll put it in my own backyard. I've watched the Detroit Tigers trade away an absolute all-star team many times just for prospects. And where are those prospects now? You know, no one ever writes except the inside baseball guys, the seam heads, you know, all right, this guy equaled these three players, but then they traded that player for this player. You could actually say that this guy ended up equaling these, you know, down the rabbit hole where you follow the thread. But the fact is, baseball prospects, you're talking about 19, 20-year-old kids, some of them from foreign countries, and you end up giving away guys who you know can get it done. To try to save yourself salary room or things like that. And then you're hoping that these guys come through. I don't know, man. In a world where you got to win today or you're not going to even have your job as a general manager.
That's the other thing.
By the time they come through. I don't know why so many guys do this.
Now, I got to push back on one thing you said about the salary cap in baseball. Because if you look at it, baseball doesn't have a salary cap, and yet they've had more different playoff teams and winners than the NFL's had the same teams winning for the last 15, 20 years. The NBA's had two or three teams winning for this. And but baseball's had more different divisional winners than any of them combined.
And why do you suppose that is?
Well, it's a different game, first of all, and also you get down to a four, you know, at the end you got, baseball doesn't have as much home field advantage. But here's the thing also about baseball that I just don't understand is that, and of course you'll appreciate this, all sports teams, they're monopolies. They are monopolies. So when somebody says our budget is $125 million and we can't go over that, I go, why not? What is the difference if you're paying that guy $30 million a year? Because at the end of the deal where you bought that team for $250 million, which is now $4 billion, it's minor money. The fans, we don't want to spend that. It's not their money. These are monopolies. They can't open up another team in that league. They Right. can't do this. These are total. So they're going to grow and grow and grow. So when I hear this, we can't afford the budget, I find that's total BS. That's an Right. arbitrary number that you've put on the team.
Yep. Yep, no, there's no question about it, and you know that's the business side
right.
of sports, and you know that so often it ends up determining it. All right, I want to bring up the Heisman Trophy just for a second. I'm not big on the Heisman Trophy for anything more than the history of what it was. I once interviewed Jay Berwanger, who won the first Heisman
wow.
Trophy ever.
Wow.
I want to say it was 1939 or 49 or something like that, and I'm sure I can look it up in a second. But anyhow, he was fascinating because, he talked about, like, well, they came up with this award, and we had to get on a train, and we had to go into New York, and nobody knew what it was, and it was like, do I really want to go all that distance from, I think he was from Chicago at the time, and he went all that way on a train in New York, and they gave him this award, and it was like, you know, okay, I got the Heisman Trophy, you know, what is it? And then he went back and kept it, I think, as a doorstop for a while until it became what it ended up being. And now, of course, it's turned into this whole other thing where, it was 1935, by the way, Chicago running back Jay Berwanger. And then he went on. I don't even think he tried to play professional football, or it didn't last for very long. And now it's become this whole other thing where, you know, they make such a big fuss of it during the course of the year. And then what does it really mean when you get into the NFL, you know? And so, okay, you take it for what it's worth. But I did find it interesting that, and this is a little bit of a deviation here, but if you go on Kyler Murray right now, if you type in Kyler Murray Heisman, and of course he had this amazing season for Oklahoma. He's a fascinating case. You're going to like him because he may end up a baseball player, Robert.
Yeah.
A lot faster than he's a football player. you will find every headline says Heisman Trophy winner Kyler Murray apologizes for anti-gay tweets posted to his account. Every headline, if you go to Google, is about that. And I look at that and I just find myself shaking my head. The minute somebody wins something today, everybody goes back into, especially if they're 21, mm-hmm. and goes back and finds out, what did you tweet when you were a teenager? And now you have to apologize for what you tweeted for when you were a teenager. This is something that did not exist in Jay Berwanger's time. Okay?
No,
I want
no,
to point
no,
out
no.
that Jay never had to go back and say, what did I say when I was 14 years old that I need to apologize for now? What's your view on all that?
Well, it's of course, it's the times we live in. It's social media. First of all, the only thing we know is that Murray will not be hosting the Oscars this year.
Yeah, okay.
That's the one thing.
I don't think anybody's actually going to be hosting the Oscars,
man,
this year, because there are no clean Twitter accounts.
It's not going to be Les Moonves either. We know that we can start ruling out some people here. But first of all, the Heisman Trophy. But yes, the social media has become a more democratic world, little d. I don't know if which makes me question democracy a little bit. It's just the world we live in. And by the way, his sport, it's not going to be that big a deal. It didn't happen during, and of course now maybe other people are going to learn from this. I mean, unfortunately/fortunately, other people are going to, not do this and say, hey, remember what happened to Murray, whatever happened to, to Kevin Hart, whatever happened. So even though they're not going to change their feelings, at least they won't be as vocal about it, perhaps.
But when you're 14 or 15,
I'm with you.
When you're 14 or 15, are you sitting around going, I'm 14, I am just about to enter high school, and there's a chance that I might win the Heisman Trophy one day,
right?
So I better be careful about what I tweet. Okay, and this business, I have so many questions when I see these stories. The first of which is, who goes and checks that stuff?
I know.
How do you go and find out what a guy said when he was 14? Where would you even begin to go? I mean, you're talking about 7 years ago. How do you go back to 7 years of tweeting and search for a single word, that he used, and then bring it up? Do you have nothing else to do in your life but to go and search that kind of stuff out?
I'm reminded of Lee Elia. Remember Lee Elia with the Cubs? Yeah. 90% of the people work and wrestle them around.
Right.
That's what has happened now. You see, it's like people have nothing else to do. So this is, they want to be, and then also here's what happened now. We have a generation where not only do they want to go back and dig it up, they got to be the first. They got to be the first to do it. So when you do that with your buddies, that's what we are in this sports talk, social media, Instagram / troll world we live in. It's just, they call it progress.
Right. See, I think the biggest thing that you can teach, they have these sessions where they start with athletes when they're even in eighth grade, teaching them how to behave and, you're going to be on a stage and you're going to need to do this and you need to do that. The thing that these coaches in junior high school should teach them is the delete button. You don't need to save tweets, right? It's not like saving photographs from mom and dad that you're going to look at one day. You don't need to save your tweets when you're 14. At the end of every, season, freshman, junior high school season, we say, all right, team, we're all going to get together at the banquet. And before we all get up there, everybody take out your devices and delete every tweet you've done in this last year as 14. You'll start all over as 15-year-olds with a clean tweet slate. Then none of this stuff would happen. But how, these guys just leave this stuff lying around. It's like never washing your clothes. They leave their tweets hanging around somewhere where someone could go back and find them when they become famous. And honestly, if you have any kind of path towards fame, any kind of path towards athletic success, you should be deleting your tweets on a weekly basis when you're young, because they ain't going to serve you any purpose later in life except to embarrass you.
Except you want your buddies to see how smart and funny you are. That's, that's also.
But you could still do that and then delete them,
that's
right?
That's true.
Nobody goes back and reads old tweets except these people who apparently make a living at finding out what somebody sent out when they were 14. Who goes back and reads their tweets?
That's true. Hey, Mitch, I want to bring up something about Detroit. I've always had a feeling about this, and this goes back to the whole idea of professional sports, sport versus commerce. Do you think since Detroit moved into – I always felt that Minnesota, when I was growing up, they had outdoor stadiums. And again, I thought it was a huge home field advantage for these teams when you had to go up there. And even though I totally get it, you had to have the domes. I get it. But do you think you've lost a little bit of the home field advantage by not playing in the elements out there?
Oh, there's no question. There's no real identity to, you know, the Detroit Lions now when they play a game. I mean, first of all, you can't say, oh, it's really loud in there. Well, in every stadium's loud. You know, you put enough people in it and you get them to make noise, or you just manufacture the noise on the big sound system. Every stadium's loud. But they've had, the Lions have been playing indoors since the advent of the Silverdome, which goes back into the, I want to say, either early 80s, or late 70s, early 80s. And not coincidentally, they've been awful all during that time. So there's no stretch, there's no identity of a football game here at all. Now, conversely, you know, Michigan plays just up the road, Michigan football, and Michigan State about an hour away. And you know, you get up here in the fall, and those are, you know, they learn how to play in the winter time. They learn how to play in cold weather. So it's not like all football teams in the area have to go indoors, just the professional team. And yeah, I do think that they've taken away a lot of that. But of course, they do it for the comfort of the fans, so that they can put more people in there. Nobody wants to come out when it's freezing cold, and especially for the Lions. You know, can you imagine what their attendance would look like if they had an outdoor stadium in December?
But if they were winning,
it'd be embarrassing.
But if they were winning, I mean, look, Green Bay.
Right, look at Green Bay.
Green Bay and Chicago have done it for the years.
Yeah.
When you talk about identity, I have always believed this about the New York Jets. Since about 1975 or about 77, they've been playing in somebody else's stadium. They've never had a home field. I mean, it's like they play in Giants, and then they play in this piece of whatever it is, this black box called MetLife, which has no character whatsoever.
And I think any time you have to, like, erase another team's logo to get ready for your game, you know, it's just not your stadium.
Yeah.
You know, I always wondered, how fast do you have to, like, pull that Giants stuff off and put the Jets stuff down and put the Jets stuff up and put the Giants stuff down when they were playing in the Meadowlands to you know, make it, oh, now this is your stadium, okay, and this is yours. So I totally agree with you. Hey, before we get out of here, you're a baseball lover.
Yep.
And I'm interested in your take on the Hall of Fame.
Glad you asked me this. What it proves to me is the disconnect between the sports writers who vote for the Hall of Fame and the people on the committee, some of whom are sports writers, by the way. And because look at Lee Smith. Lee Smith never made, I don't think, the top 15 or whatever, and yet he was a unanimous choice by that committee who played with him, played against him, who wrote about him, whatever. And where is the disconnect here? And Harold Baines, I'm happy for him. I love the fact that they're putting people in that not only, you know, make up statistics, but I'd want on my team. I like that. I do like that. But the Lee Smith thing is fascinating to me because he never got close by the sports writers.
Yeah, well, didn't we see this with Jack Morris and Alan Trammell?
You're preaching to the choir about Jack Morris. Jack Morris, you know, Jack Morris is the first player in the history of baseball who pitched his entire career in the American League during the DH era. Not one player. He's the first and only pitcher who has been elected to the Hall of Fame, who pitched his entire career in the American League during the DH era. Now, Mariano Rivera will get in this year. Maybe Mike Mussina will get in. But Jack, I mean, I was no bigger. Bob Costas always jokes about how big a Jack Morris fan I was.
You obviously never met him. No, I'm just
saying. Well, I've heard that too.
I know Jack very well. He's a very smart, often acerbic, can ruffle your feathers guy, particularly when he was playing. He's mellowed out a lot. He's become an announcer and an analyst, and I think that often does it to guys, you know, when they have to be in the booth and they have to go talk to players, and all of a sudden they say, oh, man, I remember when I behaved like that. So he has changed, but he was surly, shall we say, when he was in the locker room, and he'll be the first guy to tell you that. And of course, he's got that infamous comment to a female reporter about, I don't talk to women when I'm naked unless I'm on top of them or they're on top of me.
Ooh, and I forgot that one.
You know, yeah, that was always bad.
See?
But, you know,
it wasn't just tweets.
No, it wasn't. No, in those days they just spoke. But I'll say this about Jack, who deep down is a very good guy and a straightforward guy, and at least you know where he stands on things. Anybody who watched him, and I think this is the same for Lee Smith, anybody who was there watching him had no question that he belonged in the Hall of Fame. You just did not want to play against him, just as you didn't want to see Lee Smith coming in as a closer. You just knew, you know, he was as tough as nails, Morris was, and the same thing about Trammell. You know, he's just a gamer, and he was always there, and he came through in the clutch. But that kind of stuff doesn't show up for the guys.
For the sabermetric guys.
Exactly. Sabermetrics do not break down like clutch moments or when you need a guy to get a strikeout or whatever. I'm sorry, they can dig as much as they want into those numbers. It doesn't prove the eye test, you know. And when you were there and you say, yeah, but people were scared of him, you know, but he just glared people down. Sometimes he got guys to strike out just because the way he looked at him. That doesn't show up in sabermetrics. And so I agree with you. I love that the fact that they have this veterans committee, because in the end, nobody remembers who got you in. They just remember that you got in. And when I watched Jack Morris and Alan Trammell go in there together last year or earlier this year and make the speeches, you know, they didn't say, well, we're here with an asterisk. They look just like everybody else who got into the Hall of Fame. And thank goodness they have this veterans.
And by the way, Jack Morris, when they always point to his ERA, Jack Morris pitched his entire career at Tiger Stadium, the Toronto Sky Dome, and the Homer Dome in Minnesota. Can you think of three better hitters' parks
right
in the American League in the DH era than those three?
And here's another thing. They left him in.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they left him in. If Jack Morris was winning a game, you know, 5-0 in the sixth inning, today they take him out, and his ERA
right
would be better.
Right.
They left him in to pitch to the ninth,
yeah,
and so he gave up the first and second run. He won 5-3. Well, there goes 3 runs against his ERA, but you know what? They left him in the pitch. I mean,
to me,
if you can go 10 innings and win 1-0 in the World Series.
Seventh game.
Forget about it.
Yeah.
It's over. You know, how are you not in the Hall of Fame with that?
Also, he started three All-Star. You know, when you think of all the All-Star games, when the manager has every pitcher to give the ball to, they, you know, more times, and I think only one of the guys got started more All-Star games than Jack Morris.
Right.
So you're preaching to the choir there. And by the way, I always ask the sabermetric guys, where's the statistic for heart? Where's
right
the statistic for modern medicine? Where is the statistic for context? And it, see, that's the world we live in. And by the way, Harold Baines, you know, never drew more than 6.1% of the vote in 5 elections before he was taken off the board. And now he gets in with the, you know, with 75% of the people who he played with and against.
Yeah.
Disconnect.
All right, before we get to our parting shots, I want to say we want to thank our sponsor, Gillette, and Gillette On Demand. Now, Mike usually talks about everybody in the Lupica family going back to the pioneers who crossed the plains in the coaches shaved with Gillette. In fact, great-great-grandpa Lupica shaved with Gillette. I can only go as far back as myself and perhaps my dad, but I too use Gillette razors, have used them ever since I started shaving, have moved from the Mach 3 to the Fusion Pro Shield. Doesn't matter, as long as they're shaving me, I'm happy. And I don't even have that big a beard, and they make me look like, continue to make me look like I'm younger than I am, so I'm happy to have them. Now that Gillette On Demand has gotten into the game of getting the blades delivered directly to your door, it's better than ever. You can subscribe to Gillette On Demand today, and you can get 50% off your first order with a special offer code SPORTSREPORTERS50 at checkout. And you can enjoy free shipping every fourth order free with the subscription. So think about that. The only drawback about shaving in the past, the only drawback about Gillette razors or any razors, is that you had to go out and get them. And of course, that one day when you've got a really big job interview, you pull open your drawer and you see you're out of razors. It's not going to happen anymore, because you can have them now brought to your house on demand. Never have to go out to the shop. Never have to ask the guy to unlock the glass cabinet and say, can I please get those Gillette razors? Nope, you can do it right now with Gillette On Demand. So once more, you get 50% off your first order with special offer code SPORTSREPORTERS50 at checkout. Enjoy free shipping on every fourth order, free with subscription. And here is a brief musical interlude by Robert Wall.
That is right for you. I remember the Gillette song. By the way, here's
keep going.
Don't talk. I forgot. Just sing. I forgot.
Shut up and sing.
I forgot, Howard. Do you remember, you talk about moments, where were you when, you know, whether, do you remember the first moment you shaved with the Mach 3 razor the first time?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, man, was that the greatest thing?
And it goes right over your chin, and you don't have any of those cuts, and it's smooth. And, boy, I never knew my skin could be this clear. Yeah, I remember.
Wow. I remember.
But I do want to hear a little bit more of that song.
I don't forget. By the razor, who is right for you? Dee, 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 dee. I forget. I wish I remember the words. I don't.
Good enough. Close enough. All right. It is time for our parting shots, and though departed, Mike Lupica leads off.
It's not just complicated with Bonds and Clemens and all the other immortal users of baseball drugs when it comes to the National Baseball Hall of Fame. It's not just Pete Rose. It's George Steinbrenner, too, now. The Modern Era Committee didn't come close to electing him this time. And that means he might never get in, despite being the most influential and important baseball owner and maybe sports owner of his time. In so many ways, Steinbrenner reinvented the definition of sports owner when he came out of Cleveland to get the Yankees from CBS. The Yankees won twice in the 70s and then came back later at the end of the 90s and had arguably the greatest team they've ever had, even though the Yanks of 49 through 53 won five in a row. Steinbrenner spent and made headlines and made controversies and kept hiring and refiring Billy Martin and made the Yankees matter again. He also got kicked out of baseball twice, a world's record, once for committing the felony of illegal campaign contributions to the Richard Nixon campaign. Like I said, it's complicated with George. It's really complicated. Would I vote him in? Yeah, I would. Just not before Marvin Miller.
Robert.
What did I tell you, Met fans? When former player agent, now New York Met general manager Brody Van Wagenen, was hired, people cried, he's an agent. What does he know about running a ball club? Well, contrary to popular belief, Brody's not the first agent to run a New York ball club. 50 years ago, Sonny Werblin, a former talent agent named who once owned a fledgling AFL team called the New York Jets, recognized the star quality of a certain Alabama quarterback named Joe Namath. How did that work out? Well, did I not predict on this very show what former agent, now New York Met general manager Brody Van Wagenen was going to do? Agents like big names. So before you can say Robinson Cano, Brody brings in Robinson Cano. Before you could say Edwin Diaz, Brody brings in Edwin Diaz. And now the Mets are openly discussing trading away Noah Syndergaard and for trading in bringing in JT Realmuto. And this week, he even got more attention by dropping the name of the never-ending saga that is Tim Tebow, saying that it's not inconceivable that Tebow makes it to Citi Field this season, never mind that the 31-year-old would-be rookie has a lifetime 244 minor league average. He's Tim Tebow. He's a name. He's a star. The Mets are doing something with Brody that hasn't happened in a long time here. They're getting press. Look, they're not pushing the Yankees off the back pages yet, but they are getting more column inches. Brody is bringing show business into the Mets. They may or may not be any better, but Sonny Werblin sure would be proud.
Mm. Week after week, I talk about what it's like to be a Lions fan, how it is a unique form of, well, torture. But let me be more specific. Take the case of Eric Ebron. The Lions chose him with the 10th pick of the 2014 draft. The 10th pick. How often does a team pick a tight end with the 10th pick, especially when a guy named Aaron Donald is still on the board? But that's the Lions, the same team who once made Andre Ware a number one pick. So here comes Ebron out of that football powerhouse, North Carolina, and he plays 4 years in Detroit and is almost always a disappointment. You can count on him to drop a ball when things matter the most. He gets booed. He gets criticized. And last offseason, he gets gone. The Lions released him, yet another first-round pick, dropped off the roster altogether. So what happens? He signs with Indianapolis, and he already has as many catches and yards as all but one of his Detroit seasons, and by the time this year is over, he'll have his best season statistically, and the way the Colts are going, he may even see the playoffs. And the Lions? They haven't got a tight end left standing, and were last seen being terrorized by the Rams' Aaron Donald, a guy they could have picked instead of Ebron in the first place. You want to know what it's like to be a Lions fan? Come to Detroit, say the name Eric Ebron, and watch the reaction. That's what it's like. That's going to wrap it up for today's Sports Reporters Podcast. We do this every Monday and Friday. Yes, if you just tuned in and said, boy, I didn't even know this existed. Well, this is the continuation of the longtime TV show on ESPN. And twice a week gives us a chance to reflect on what happened and what's coming up. So we will be here this Friday. You can tell your friends that they can listen to our podcast wherever you get popular podcasts, particularly at radio.com/sportsreporters. Until we see you on Friday, on behalf of Robert Wall and Mike Lupica, this is Mitch Albom saying, have a great week.